with highs near 34 and west winds 5 to 10. Lows tomorrow night in the low teens, and for Friday, mostly cloudy, highs near 29.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Brin Rundle. Coming up on As It Happens.
An activist in Minneapolis tells us about the emergency vigil planned for the 37-year-old woman killed by an ICE agent this morning.
And Web of Spies, the late Aldrich Ames is remembered by a journalist who developed a connection with the Cold War double agent who sold secrets to the Soviets. He tells us he believes that Ames betrayed his country for love, not politics.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
We'll have more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on People Powered KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Curl Masabi invites you to Burger Night this Friday, 5:30 to 8 at the Eveleth Curling Club. It's a chance to learn the sport of curling in a welcoming environment. Be sure to bring in clean athletic shoes and wear comfortable clothing. And Grand Rapids Players presents Insomniacs Saturday, January 10th, 7 o'clock in the Ives Studio Theater at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. See several short scenes which have been written within the past 24 hours. We're going to hear some new music now. This is Sophie Gault. The song is called Pocket Change.
Where's my Studebaker? I'm nobody's pocket change. Jingle when you want to throw around some card game with pencils and old receipts you had to keep to save your ass. Where's my Studebaker? I'm nobody's pocket change. I don't want to love you
I don't want.
from her latest album, Unhinged. That is Sophie Gault. The song is called Pocket Change here on KAXC. We'll have more from As It Happens in just a few moments. And coming up at 7 o'clock, Isaac M., volunteer host for On the River. It's his debut show. That is from 7 to 10. Great mix of music. And at 10 o'clock, Kari Headland, your host for Headwaters, another great source for music. A few live music events to let you know about this weekend. Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club are playing in Coleraine at Smoke on the Water, 5 o'clock. And on Saturday, Brian Pelkovich is at the Canna Wine Bar in Crosby. That's at 6 o'clock. You can let us know about live music happening in your region. Send us an email, comments@kaxc.org. It's time to continue with All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
an activist in Minneapolis tells us about plans to honor the 37-year-old woman shot dead by an ICE agent this morning. It is a shooting federal government officials insist was done in self-defense. The city's mayor says video proves that assertion is, quote, garbage.
Power shift. A former member of Venezuela's opposition says he's losing patience with Donald Trump, who he says is not moving fast enough to push for true change in his country.
Death of a spy. With the passing of the infamous double agent Aldrich Ames, a journalist who knew him well tells us his motivation wasn't ideological, but a twisted love story.
Happy hunting. We hear from a Quebec researcher who learns about how predators and prey move in the wild through a serious game of adult tag.
Slippery slope. A marriage proposal on a ski vacation goes downhill fast when the hopeful groom-to-be drops the ring.
And blast from the past. The sound of war horns once struck fear in the hearts of Roman soldiers facing Celtic warrior tribes. But we hear from an archaeologist who was delighted to discover one of the Iron Age instruments on the site of an English housing development. As It Happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that rarely toots its own horn. Today, an ICE agent shot and killed a woman in Minneapolis. It comes at a tense moment in the city after 2,000 additional federal agents were deployed there this week. In a video circulating online, the officer can be seen shooting the driver of a car through the driver's side of the vehicle. Dozens of protesters arrived at the scene of the shooting today, and more are expected to gather tonight at a vigil. Tonight, U.S. media are identifying the victim as 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good. Nakima Levy Armstrong is a civil rights lawyer. She leads the local Racial Justice Network and will be speaking at the vigil. We reached her in Minneapolis earlier this evening.
Nakima, how did you find out what had happened?
I started receiving phone calls shortly after it happened. And from there, I looked on social media as well.
On social media and on news outlets, there is video of those moments gathered from the scene. It happens very quickly. It's quite disturbing. Our CBC News colleagues have verified that video. But from what you understand, what happened?
From what I understand, ICE obviously has made it its mission to descend upon Minneapolis, calling this their largest deployment. And every day, protesters and observers show up on the scene where they know that that ICE is looking for people, and they stand outside as observers. And you know, this morning was no different. I think the difference is that an ICE agent brutally opened fire on a woman as she was trying to drive away. And from our understanding, it's a 37-year-old woman. The incident has been confirmed. They've already tried to spin it, claiming that the woman tried to run them over. Anyone who's seen the video knows that that is absolutely not true. she was trying to drive away, and they opened fire. And not only did they open fire, but they shot this woman in the head, which is a kill shot.
The people who called you, and I know you get calls like this often, given the work that you do, what were they saying this morning?
I received calls from fellow organizers and activists who were shocked and upset to find out that a woman had been killed. So some people broke down crying. Others were, you know, under distress and duress, you know, in terms of their voices. And then from that point, you know, people just started organizing.
People have been very clear, those who are opposed to the ICE presence and vocal. And we spoke with an ACLU lawyer on the program yesterday who said people in the city were worried, were frightened, and that they didn't expect an escalation of this size. Were you expecting something like this?
I was expecting there to be a heavier ICE presence. I wasn't expecting them to use deadly force on a woman under these circumstances. I'm not completely surprised that they would use deadly force, but I am surprised that they would use deadly force under these circumstances.
As in
Minneapolis.
Yeah, as you and those you work with, those who are opposed to this and want to make their voices heard and protest, how do you prepare them for what might happen? How do you work to keep them safe as well, or to prevent things from escalating?
Honestly, anytime we're out on the front lines and we are opposing actions by the government, and typically it's violence by the government, we can't guarantee safety of everyone who is out there. You know, we do our best, but there's no way to guarantee people's safety 100% when we're out on the front lines protesting or in a vigil or even observing. So that's the first thing that people need to understand. This is very dangerous. So it honestly, unfortunately, comes with the territory of fighting back.
You've described, and those organizing the vigil, the 37-year-old woman as an observer. You've used that word to describe others as well who are taking part in these protests. As you know, the U.S. president and others who agree with him have painted a different picture of people who are gathered there, and specifically this 37-year-old woman. What do you say to those who are painting her as something other than an observer or even a protester?
I think that it's despicable and disgusting to spread lies about people who care about humanity and who are trying to protect their neighbors. The people who are violent and who are vicious in all of this are the ICE agents. The people here in the Twin Cities are simply doing their duty as humanitarians and those who care about justice. When they show up to protect their neighbors. And there's very little that they can do other than shouting at ICE agents, you know, and verbalizing their concerns. But the government has all the power in terms of the weapons, in terms of access to the media, in terms of their willingness to use deadly force at the drop of a dime.
We're reaching you just before the vigil that's been organized that you were mentioning. You are set to speak at that vigil. What do you want to convey? What do you want to get across to folks in your city?
I want the people in our city to know that we are standing on the right side of justice and the right side of history. And it is important for us to be vigilant in standing up for our neighbors and pushing back against this authoritarian regime and the violence that they have been inflicting upon our communities. And we can't continue to allow our government to get away with this type of violence and oppression and murder. It's completely diabolical and unacceptable.
Nakima, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Nakima Levy Armstrong is an activist and a civil rights lawyer. We reached her earlier this evening in Minneapolis. was nearing the end of the Cold War, and Aldrich Ames had secrets to sell. So the American spy struck a deal with the KGB, and that turned him into the most murderous turncoat in the history of the CIA. Starting in the mid-80s and continuing for nearly a decade, Mr. Ames passed along some of his nation's deepest secrets, including the names of Soviets secretly working with the West from behind the Iron Curtain. His actions led to the deaths of at least 10 agents, and it forced many more to flee for their lives, like former KGB spy Oleg Gordievsky, who was working for MI6.
I would have been executed. Oh, yes.
No question.
That's why I decided to try the escape, because I knew I would be executed anyway. Just no doubt about it.
Right.
So when my chances to escape were very few, it still was better than a sure death, certain death, which expected me.
If you could talk to Ames tonight, what would you want to ask him?
My first question would be, Mr. Ames, was it you who gave me away to the KGB in May 1985?
Yeah.
And my second question would be, Mr. Ames, is it really only money you were led by working for the secret political police of a totalitarian state?
Was
there something else?
Well, you did it for ideology and political reasons. He seems to have done it for the money.
Yes, it seems so. Yes. Maybe he was a secret supporter of Fidel Castro. I don't know, through his wife.
Double agent Oleg Gordievsky speaking with former As It Happens host Michael Enright in 1994, just after Aldrich Ames was arrested. The ex-CIA spy died this week in a Maryland prison where he was serving a life sentence for espionage. He was 84. Pete Early knew Mr. Ames well. He interviewed him just after he was arrested for his book, Confessions of a Spy, and they kept in touch over the years. We reached Mr. Early in Fairfax County, Virginia.
Pete, the relationship between a source and a journalist, particularly when we're talking about one that spans so many years, can be an interesting, maybe even complicated one. How would you describe your relationship with Ames over the years?
Well, I found him fascinating. I also felt like the public wasn't really getting a true image of him, because from the moment he was arrested, the FBI was trying to take credit and the CIA was trying to say, oh, he was this drunk who didn't know what he was doing. And, you know, he just kind of slipped through the cracks, which wasn't the case. I mean, for 17 years, he basically ran Soviet operations. So if this man who admittedly had a serious drinking problem was so inept, then why did the CIA at the fall of the Soviet Union put him in charge of, as they put it, putting a knife into the back of the KGB?
What was it like the first time you met? What do you remember about that?
Well, it was pretty unique about meeting him, because what had happened, he was arrested. And of course, it was a huge national story, a huge scandal. And the U.S. attorney came out and said, look, he's in jail. We're not going to allow him to do interviews. And they announced that everywhere, but they forgot to tell the jail. And I drove over to the jail and said, I want to see Aldrich Ames. And within an hour, I was sitting down with him, and I spent 15 days with him before anybody realized I was there, and they kicked me out. And that was interesting, because during that time period, without a censor there, I really got a sense of who he was. And it was almost the banality of evil. And then, of course, he asked me, he said, I'm talking to you because I want to tell my side. He, like all spies, they want to justify. But he also had an ulterior motive, which he gave me a letter of introduction to meet with the SVR KGB in Moscow. Mm. And he wanted me to mention that they were holding money for him and that he wanted it delivered to Columbia to his wife.
Well, so we heard from Oleg Gordievsky there before our interview began. I know you've spoken to him before. He said, he told you, Ames did, that he did not betray him. Do you believe him?
Well, it's not a question whether I believe him. It's the people of the CIA believe him, actually, mm-hmm. tell you the truth. You look at it, Ames gave up every possible name he could. I mean, he gave up the name of a retired general who wasn't even active in spying anymore. And they dragged him out, and the KGB dragged him out and shot him in the back of the head and buried him in an unmarked cave. I mean, he had no reason. Why would he need to lie about Gordievsky? But what's more important is the CIA mole hunters have looked at this over and over and over again, and the timing doesn't seem to fit. And they're worried about that, because if it wasn't Ames and it wasn't Robert Hansen who followed him, then that means the United States had another Russian spy who's never been caught.
What do you think motivated Ames in the end? I mean, I've been reading about that he felt he could compartmentalize things, and that's why he was able to do what he did. And he did have an impact. It impacted lives, brought about deaths, as you said there.
Yeah.
But what motivated him? Why? Why all of a sudden?
Well, 10 people were executed because of him, and a total of 20 were jailed, imprisoned, and other. He did tremendous damage. He took all of our contacts and wiped them out basically overnight. Now, when I met with the KGB, the generals were very clear. They said, look, with Americans, there is no mystery. It's always for the money. And yes, if you look at the surface, it was for the money. He was in the midst of a nasty divorce. He needed $50,000 to get out of the divorce. But meanwhile, he had fallen in love in Mexico with Rosario, and she was this hot Latin number, and he was in a midlife crisis, as cliche as that sounds. And he envisioned this life with her as being an international figure, a real powerful guy. And he had this younger woman. And then he needed this $50,000. And so he said, well, I'll give him three names that are really just fake. And they ended up giving him $50,000. And then he realized that all of our sources, all the people working for us, would hear about him giving names to the KGB and turn him into the CIA. And so that's when he went and he basically gave the name of everybody he could. But what, to answer your question, Ames's own rationalization and view ended up jiving with what the CIA investigators felt, that if he'd never met Rosario, if he'd never fallen in love with her and wanted to impress her and needed to be the big man, he probably never would have spied. So in an ironic way, Ames himself told me, he said, I did it for love, which is pretty romantic considering that he did it for love over the bodies of 10 people.
Yeah, I don't know if that's my kind of romance or most people's kind of romance. When was the last time you saw Ames?
Well, I haven't seen him since he was put in prison, sent up for life since 94. The last letter I got was about a year ago when he was getting ill and I was diagnosed with cancer. So we kind of ended the relationship. But I always found it fascinating because he still was intrigued. You know, this is a guy who lived in a kind of a moral abyss. There were no white knights, no dark knights. There were just no knights at all. It was just him and his wants and self-rationalization. But he loved the spy game. And even his last letter to me, he was about the Trump administration and how Putin was manipulating Trump. And I mean, he was staying on top of all that. And he also insisted in every letter that he did no harm, that the people who died died because they had betrayed their country, and he was in prison because he betrayed his. And so he felt no remorse at all about their deaths.
Pete, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Pete Early is a journalist and the author of Confessions of a Spy, The Real Story of Aldrich Ames. We reached him in Fairfax County, Virginia. I think we all know just how cutthroat the game of tag can be, and that's without the pressure of your very existence hanging in the balance, you know, most of the time. But researchers at Laval University have upped the ante, adding simulated death as a fun and instructive new layer. It's a way to model predator-prey behavior in animals. The concept is simple. Stick a couple dozen players in a forest, designate them either predator or prey, and let the games begin. David Bolduc is an ecologist and a co-author of the study published in the journal Methods in Ecology and Evolution. We reached him in Quebec City.
David, what is your heart rate like when you're the prey in this scenario?
Pretty high, both because I'm very excited to play and because you can quickly feel the risk of being caught by a predator, and that's very, very nice.
Were you very good at tag when you were younger in school? Is that why you wanted to do a project like this?
I don't know if I was good, but I was very keen on playing. Yeah. So I think that what mattered here.
So who did you recruit to take part?
So I designed this game with a colleague of mine, Frédéric Dudet-Lebrun. And once we had the game set up, we ran a few trials. And after that, we recruited about 30 graduate students from around the world. And we all met in Valmorin, and we tried to play the game for to make a bit of science out of that.
And I'm trying to imagine that first conversation where, you know, you're bringing them in, folks from around the world, as you said. How did you explain your vision?
That's a good question. I think everybody was very enthusiastic about trying something new. So they were very open-minded about it. And the first conversation was like, okay, everybody, we're going to try something that's not been made before, we think. And here are the rules. Yeah.
And how did they react? They were in? They were no questions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everybody was very excited to play. And afterward, we were... you know, thinking about the limits of that game and also what it can bring to the science fields we're in.
Let's talk first about the rules. What are they? How did this all play out?
The rules are pretty simple. So it's really similar to a game of tag, but with some additions. So you have, for the basic rules, you have two types of players. You have predators and prey. The prey, they need to grab some resources in the environment, and they also have access to refuge so they can hide from the predator. And the predator, well, they can run around the arena, the place where we play, and they need to catch prey. We also created a speed difference between the player types, so predators can run around, whereas preys can only walk at all times, so they can be caught by predators.
And is there one winner in the end? I mean, what is winning at the end of this game?
That's a good question. There's no one winner. You either die or survive. So let's say for a predator, the objective is to catch at least one prey during the imparted time. Whereas for prey players, they need to grab a certain amount of resource within the, usually it's like 30 minutes, and also not get caught by a predator. So if you have enough food and you don't get eaten, you survive, and that's considered winning.
And the folks who were in the predator group, what did they tell you about slipping into that mindset? Did they find it easy or difficult?
It's not that easy. Because obviously preys don't want to be caught. Mm-hmm. So predators need to expend a lot of energy to grab anything.
You had GPS trackers on every player as well. As you looked back at their movements, was there anything that stood out to you or surprised you?
There are a few things that really stood out. The main thing is that predator players were using trails a lot to survey the area we were playing in and detect prey players. And this is something we can see also in nature. So let's say we're building roads in the forest. Well, we'll see that wolves will tend to use these roads and get more prey.
At the same time, this is a game for humans. It's not a game to animals. So is it really an accurate way to model animal behavior?
No, it's not. It's a good starting point, though. So let's say you're interested in some hypothesis that you would like to test in the wild. It might be good to test it with this game first, because you can probably see very interesting things. You can feel things that you haven't thought about before, and you can also readily develop the analytical tools that you'll need once you'll try it out in the wild.
What do you hope ultimately people take away from what you've done here?
I think it's just a really new, interesting, and fun way to think about ecological theory, mm-hmm. and also to learn about it. When we were playing at the end of each game, it really sparked really interesting discussions between players about ecological theory and animal behavior. And it really stood out as a great tool to teach that theory to students that would be interested.
David, thank you for this.
Hey, that was super fun. Thank you.
David Balduc is an ecologist at Laval University. He was in Quebec City. At Boyne Mountain in Michigan, there's something called a sky bridge that's long and high up and allows visitors a beautiful view of the ski resort that runs it. Danielle Jenkins wanted to go check it out, hearing it was beautiful in the winter. So Trevor Van Camp, her longtime boyfriend, decided it would be the perfect place to ask her to marry him. He had it all planned out, even a subtle way to ensure that the big moment was captured on video.
I told her, I said, I'm going to have the couple behind us take a picture. And so I went and told him, and I whispered into the lady's ear, I said, I'm going to propose. I'm shaking because I'm scared of heights. And I'm afraid she's going to say no, this, that, and the other. Just a domino effect of things, really.
Still, Mr. Van Camp got down on one knee, pulled out a ring, and asked Ms. Jenkins to marry him. And she said yes. And then she said this. Let's hear that one more time.
Did it drop it?
He had just dropped it, causing the ring to fall 36 meters onto the snow-covered ski hill below. And then she changed her mind. No, she didn't. The couple then spent the next 2 hours searching for the ring with the help of ski resort staff and a metal detector. Eventually, they realized the effort was futile and went home, ringless. But unbeknownst to the couple, the staff kept up the search, and by morning had reached out to alert them they'd found the ring. The new fiancés are so grateful they've decided to take their vows at the ski resort next year, to have and to hold, and one assumes, to definitely not let it slip through your fingers. Here's the Busy Boys with Droppin' It.
Years of watching the behavior of an MC, I came to the conclusion that a sucker mind is empty. What I'm trying to say is ingenuity is lacking. Full participation is the only thing I'm asking. Focus your full attention on every word that is expressed, uttered, announced, spoken, or told. Swallow it whole, then let my science explode. But still I'm classified as a sucker, so I overlook. Then invent a rhyme to get them wise. But you're too busy being beamed up to the enterprise. You have no grasp, no concept, no nothing. But then you criticize the rhymes that I be busting. How can you do this when you're spanking brand new to this? Be aware that I'm not the MC to this. I'm just a man that enjoys this type of music. And you don't have the faintest idea of how to use it. For the next few minutes, please let me enlighten you. But don't bite into, or I'll be fighting you. And then that one.
The Busy Boys with Droppin' It.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we return, a former Venezuelan opposition politician says Maduro may be gone, but his regime is still very much in charge in that country.
And blown away, the archaeologist who discovered an Iron Age war horn beneath the site of a new housing development explains the significance of his jaw-dropping find.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle.
Do I have to take it that you whack time and time again? Here's a brief example of a complicated cut. Like this, a cut like that would not be needed. If not used correctly, then the purpose is defeated. For example, sounds much better.
However, you're listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7, Isaac M., your volunteer host for On the River. It'll be a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, Kari Hedlund, your host for Headwaters. Support comes from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. The Sac Simbog near Meadowlands has a snowshoe hike this Sunday from 9 to 1, exploring the Sac's wildlife management area. Register in advance at sacsim.org. It is Take a Kid Ice Fishing Weekend, January 17th through the 19th, all across Minnesota. Residents may fish or spear without a license when accompanied by a child age 15 or younger. There is a special event Saturday, January 17th, 1 to 3 at Lake Bemidji State Park. Equipment and heated shelters will be provided. We continue with As It Happens on KAXE.
For Venezuela's long-suffering opposition parties, Nicolas Maduro's forced removal by the U.S. seemed like a godsend. But now their expectations are coming down to earth. Supporters of opposition leaders Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez are increasingly alarmed that Mr. Maduro's party is still firmly in power, and that the Trump administration is showing willingness to work with the current regime. Today, though, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio tried to calm fears, saying there is a plan for the political future of Venezuela. That plan starts with stabilizing the country, then ensuring that American and other companies have fair access to the Venezuelan market. He listed a political transition as a last step. Diego Sheriff Kerr is a former Venezuelan opposition politician who now lives in the U.S. We reached him in Washington.
Diego, the U.S. Secretary of State says a transition of power is third on his list of priorities. Does that worry you?
It does. It does worry me, and it worries most Venezuelans because the dictator's in jail, but the dictatorship is still alive and well in Venezuela. So the only way for Venezuelans to be able to live a normal life and for the country to return to a functioning state is if there's a transition to democracy.
We spoke earlier this week with another guest about interim leader Delcy Rodriguez and the concerns about this being, in your view and their view, a continuation of the Maduro regime. What kind of timeline would either ease your concerns or increase them?
Regarding timelines, the sooner the better, because again, even though Maduro's not in power, those that followed Maduro's orders, Delcy Rodriguez as vice president, the minister of defense, the minister of interior that oversees the police, the director of the secret police, all the generals. So again, the whole structure, the whole criminal structure that was repressing, torturing, killing of Venezuelans on a daily basis are still in power. So the longer they stay in power, the longer they'll be making Venezuelans suffer. And again, in these last couple of days, we've been able to see paramilitary forces dressed as civilians with weapons, stopping people on the streets, checking their phones, seeing if they're criticizing the government, and throwing them in jail. So that will continue to happen on a daily basis as long as the same people are in power.
What could it look like? How would it look like in your ideal scenario? I mean, tomorrow, would you say in your view, you would like tomorrow the U.S. to say, okay, Gonzalez and Machado can come in and pick up where they had intended to start, you know, after the election?
Yeah. Well, if it were, the ideal scenario would be the U.S. finishes the job of guaranteeing a transition towards democracy, that there is a power sharing deal where there's negotiation, where there is a sharing of power between the Edmundo Gonzalez and the current regime with a very clear timeline of or new elections or let's say Edmundo Gonzalez finally taking complete power of the Venezuelan state.
Ms. Machado, as you know, certainly courted the Trump administration. She dedicated her Peace Prize to Donald Trump. She really tried to reach the what the U.S. administration, this U.S. administration, likes to hear about: economic opportunities, oil. Do you think that is a strategy, given where you're at right now, that backfired?
It's complicated. I do think there's no doubt that transition to democracy in Venezuela depends on the support of the international community, with the United States playing a fundamental role there. For years, the Venezuelan population and the Venezuelan people have been struggling and fighting for democracy and for a transition through protests and through voting in elections. And it's obvious that the regime just used all its power to repress, kill, torture Venezuelans. We do need the U.S. administration, if that's President Biden during the previous administration or now currently Trump, to continue to play a very active role in the transition. We now need the Western world and real democracies to help reconstruct the country. So the U.S. should play a very active role in reconstructing Venezuela once the transition happens.
But they're saying, you know, they appear to be willing to work with Delcy Rodriguez right now. And also, as you know, Donald Trump has said Maria Corina Machado lacks popular support to run the country. Obviously, last year's election results say something different. But yes, you needed the U.S. to help and put pressure. But are you concerned that they are not going to deliver on what you and others hoped they would?
Very concerned. And those were very unfortunate remarks by President Trump about, let's say, the current regime, as well as Maria Corina Machado. It was demonstrated in the elections last year that the opposition led by Maria Corina, again, has 70% of the support of the Venezuelan population. Those remarks by President Trump were very disappointing and a real shock for most of us Venezuelans.
Knowing what you know, having experienced what you've experienced and your friends you mentioned as well, your pro-democracy activist, you know, wanting the U.S. to exert pressure and help bring about change is one thing. What happened over the weekend, the U.S. attack on Venezuela, and then Maduro's appearance in a New York courtroom this week, how did that turn of events sit with you?
Amazingly well, and I'll be completely honest. I was a city council member in Caracas. I was detained for 8 hours the day Maduro was elected in 2013 by the secret police. As I mentioned, a friend of mine, also a city council member in Caracas, was tortured and killed in Venezuela, Fernando Albán. Another close friend of mine, member of the National Assembly, was tortured in jail and was detained for multiple years. He's now free. Another close friend of mine was detained for years in a secret prison underground where he never saw the sunlight for years. Until there was a negotiation with the Spanish government and he was freed. So seeing Maduro behind bars in the U.S. is justice, is what Venezuelans wanted. It's the end, the beginning, or an important step towards the end of the dictatorship that has killed, tortured, and make Venezuelans suffer. So it's important for us. And Saturday was a day when I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning with all the news of what was going on. It was a day of immense happiness for all of us to have suffered the consequences of a regime in Venezuela. The question is now in the details. Like, how does this not only become a change of face of who's leading the regime, but actually a transition towards democracy where we as Venezuelans can decide our own future? And that's what we're hoping to continue pressuring to ensure, that this transition is as quick as possible, that it's the Venezuelan people who can decide our own future, and that we have the support of the democratic international community to ensure that it's as peaceful as possible and as long-lasting as we can.
It's good to speak with you, Diego. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Diego Sheriff Kerr is a former Venezuelan opposition politician who now lives in the U.S. He was in Washington, D.C. Earlier on tonight's program, we told you about the tension building in Minneapolis tonight after an ICE agent shot and killed a woman there. That's after the Trump administration deployed 2,000 additional federal agents to the city. Last night, lawyer Alicia Granzi with the local ACLU told us people in the city are terrified and that she was worried about ICE agents violating people's constitutional rights.
Minnesota local officials, Minnesota's elected officials all should know that, you know, they need to stand up for the rights of Minnesotans because it's more important now than ever.
Are you confident that they'll do that?
You know what? I'm going to choose to have faith today. I'm going to choose to think that, yes, our local officials will stand up for Minnesotans.
Shortly after today's shooting in Minneapolis, Mayor Jacob Frey held a press conference. Here's part of what he said for the record.
We collectively are going to do everything possible to get to the bottom of this, to get justice, and to make sure that there is an investigation that is conducted in full. But what we do know is that a 37-year-old woman is dead and that she was shot by ICE. We've dreaded this moment since the early stages of this ICE presence in Minneapolis. Not only is this a concern that we've had internally, we've been talking about it. They are not here to cause safety in this city. What they are doing is not to provide safety in America. What they are doing is causing chaos and distrust. They're ripping families apart. They're sowing chaos on our streets. And in this case, quite literally killing people. They are already trying to spin this as an action of self-defense. Having seen the video of myself, I want to tell everybody directly, that is This was an agent recklessly using power that resulted in somebody dying. There's little I can say, again, that'll make this situation better, but I do have a message for our community, for our city, and I have a message for ICE. To ICE, get the out of Minneapolis. We do not want you here. Your stated reason for being in this city is to create some kind of safety, and you are doing exactly the opposite. Next, a message to our community. Look, we all know that the agenda of this Trump administration is to create chaos. Let us respond right now with our best versions of self. This is a moment where all of us, in Minneapolis and beyond, we can rise to the occasion. We can show them who we are. We can show them the kind of courage, bravery, love, and compassion that makes Minneapolis, Minneapolis, and that makes America, America. They want us to respond in a way that creates a military occupation in our city. They want an excuse to come in and show the kind of force that will create more chaos and more despair. Let's not let them.
For the record, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey speaking earlier today. It started out as a regular job for Mark Hinman's company. Mr. Hinman is the CEO of Pre-Construct Archaeology. His team is routinely called in to assess sites in the UK that are slated for development to make sure they're not endangering any previously unidentified artifacts. But what they found at the site of a new housing development in West Norfolk was anything but ordinary and likely dates back to the first century AD. We reached Mr. Hinman in Cambridge, England.
So, Mark, your team is doing some routine but important work at the site to get started. When did you learn there could be something of significance here?
Right, yes, we were working on quite a small project, one of many that we do in any given year. And for some reason, the team got the idea into their head that there might be a human burial somewhere on the site. And so they were digging quite carefully, and all of a sudden they got an amazing signal from the metal detector.
That's always exciting, I'm sure, it starts ringing or making that noise. So once that starts going off, when does it then become a point where they say, I think you should come down here?
Well, amazingly fast, actually. I mean, they were fantastic because they had such a strong signal. They could see various metal objects just being uncovered in the ground, and they resisted the temptation to just dive in and dig them all up. So they took some photos on their phones, and they sent them to myself and to our metalwork expert, who's called Tom. And he was working on another site on the other side of Norfolk. But as soon as he saw the pictures, he got in his car and started heading to this this excavation. Then I got in my car from Cambridge and I started heading to the excavation. And they managed to dig around the objects and not disturb them and lift them in a block of soil. We tried to figure out what to do with it and managed to get the local hospital, Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge, to do a CT scan.
Have you done this before, or did they look at you quizzically when you said, we have a block of dirt, we need you to scan?
Yeah, we did it after hours, so it didn't disturb any of their patients or anything, but they have a brand new state-of-the-art CT scanner, and we put the block of soil in it, and we didn't know it was going to work, but it was incredible. We could see all of the detail of all of the objects in three dimensions, in high resolution detail. But we still had to wait, you see. Even though we could see the objects in the block of soil, we then had to contact experts at Norwich Castle Museum and got them to help us dig the objects out of the block of soil.
What was it like to see them up close?
It was fantastic. The objects are of such quality and of such artistic craftsmanship that when you see them in reality, they really do jump out at you. And it's almost as if they're still alive and looking at you. Mm. They're so good.
One in particular is getting a lot of attention. I don't know if it's your favorite, but it's a horn, right?
It is, yes. So there was the horn, and that is, I think it's everybody's favourite. But we mustn't forget the boar standard, the head of a wild boar made in copper alloy, which is unique to Britain. It's the first one ever found. Or the five Iron Age shield bosses that were covering the Iron Age war horn, or carnyx, as it's called. It's supposed to represent a sort of wild boar, or the head of a wild boar. It's got a presence to it. It's hard to describe. It's really the most complete carnyx ever found in Britain or Europe, because when they're buried, they're broken up deliberately. So really, this offers us an opportunity to be the first to recreate carnyx the way they really were.
We have some audio. Museum Scotland mm-hmm. had a replica made and then played it. So we'll play that for you and our listeners just briefly. Is that what you imagine it sounding like? I mean, that piece
that's it, really interesting. That's the Deskford Carnyx, yes, and it's in the National Museum of Scotland. It's the only one from the UK that survives. Two are found, but we've been working with Fraser Hunter, who's the curator at the National Museum of Scotland, who's the international expert on these carnices. But he would tell you, even though he's got the only one, until we found this one in the country, that ours is a lot better, and we'll be able to get a much more realistic recreation.
Tell our listeners what you think a carnyx of this kind would have been used for at that time.
Right. Well, many people assume that they were only really used in battles and in war, but when you see how delicate and fragile this instrument is, it would be like taking a Stradivarius into the front lines of World War One. I mean, it wouldn't survive. It's so fragile. But so it would have been used at ceremonies, important gatherings, important meetings with very important people during the first century BC and into the first century AD in Norfolk, which is obviously at this time the territory of the Iceni and Queen Boudica. So many people ask, well, would she have heard or seen this object? Of course, we don't know that, but it's of such high quality and status, it would have been an appropriate instrument to play in royal court or the special important gatherings. Now, why it was then taken and broken into pieces and put in the ground, we don't know. Where it was made, we don't know at the moment, but we're going to find out exactly how old it was and how old the other objects were. We don't know, but we're going to find out. So it's going to be a lot of science and a lot of expert musicians involved in recreation. And it's been wonderful, actually. Although these objects have lain in the ground for so long, and because we never found anything like this before, you wonder what on earth you're going to do. These experts just come and they give their time freely and willingly, and their expertise is just wonderful. Yeah, it's just been a joy.
It's been wonderful speaking with you, Mark. Thank you for this.
It's a real pleasure, and thank you for asking me.
Mark Hinman is the CEO of Preconstruct Archaeology. He was in Cambridge, England. When Bill McHale responded to a fire Monday night, it wasn't your typical call. Mr. McHale is the fire chief in Douglas, Ontario, west of Ottawa. Two local businesses, the Douglas Diner and the Douglas Trading Post, were on fire. Ultimately, the building housing both could not be saved. That would have been hard enough on its own, but for Mr. McHale, the loss is also personal. The current owners had taken over the property from his parents, who'd operated it as the Douglas Tavern for nearly 50 years.
The fire call came in exactly at 8 o'clock, and it was one of our firefighters that actually seen the smoke and called 911. There was lots of different colors of smoke, and anybody that in our industry, you'll know different colors of smoke mean different styles of fire. But what we were up against was three different roof lines in that building. It had been added on a couple of times, and the fire seemed to be smoldering until it got enough air, and it did. We just couldn't get the water in the right places. Somebody said yesterday it was like a game of whack-a-mole. We would win one, and it would pop up somewhere else, and we would get that one and pop up somewhere else. But the fire had been going, we believe, for quite some time before it was ever noticed.
Yeah. You know, the building, as we've been saying, has a long history. It started out as a hotel in the 1800s. You were actually a toddler when your parents took it over, the tavern, from relatives in 1972. What do you remember about growing up there?
Family. Every event we ever hosted there, Mom and Dad had, over the years, and there might have been 10 paid employees throughout the years, maybe a dozen, but every time there was any big function, we couldn't have done it without family. And Mom and Dad's brothers and sisters, when there was an event at the hotel, and I talked to people yesterday, it sounds redundant, but there was, at every table, there'd be a grandma, a grandpa, a mom and dad, and a pair of children. It was a generational event all the time.
Why was it nicknamed the Diddley?
My father, back in the day when he would hold a baby on his lap, he would bounce that baby on his knee and he would go diddly, 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 diddly. And all of a sudden it took on, and that's, and it is the, and one thing you'll find in the valley, nicknames can become around in a pretty stupid way, but that's actually what the only way we can think of how it came.
Oh, that's funny. You had a wall of fame in that building,
yes,
as well. What is that? It had all these kinds of names on it, just jammed.
So my younger son, Seamus, he's on our department, but Seamus came out to me on the street and he said, the board is gone. What it was a monument to the people of the area. And with a donation, your name could go on that wall. And Mom and Dad were renowned for fundraising. And every time they could make a dollar for somebody else, but with a $100 donation, your name went on the wall. And that money, what they'd do is try and get 10 names, and every $1,000 went directly to the Renfrew Hospital.
Bill McHale is the fire chief in Douglas, Ontario. He was speaking with CBC's Rebecca Zandbergen on Ottawa Morning.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard right across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neen Cooksall. Take care.
Evening. This is 91.7 KXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kexe.org. Good evening, everybody. My name is Isaac, your volunteer host for On the River. We are People Powered Radio, like I said, in northern Minnesota, and it's a pleasure to be with you this evening. A beautiful January evening. 31 degrees Fahrenheit right now in Grand Rapids. And I'm excited to spend the evening with you. I got 3 hours of great music coming your way.